War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello and welcome to another Parthenon Podcast Network roundtable discussion. This is the third one we've had. We've met previously and we discussed first, who would you kill if you could go back in history and just wipe out somebody? Who would you take out? And then we had another one, I'm sure you remember, who would you save? It was just the opposite. And how would that change history? Tonight, we have a different idea. We're going to talk about what event in history would you make not happen? If you could go back in time and just eliminate an event rather than a single person, what event would you eliminate? And we agreed up front that you cannot eliminate 9/11. It's kind of our JFK assassination of this one. It's too easy, too obvious. So I am here with the other members. This is James Early, by the way. You figured that out. This is James Early. I'm the host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. And I'm joined by my fellow Parthenon Podcast Network podcasters. We have the host of the flagship podcast of our network, History Unplugged, Dr. Scott Rank. How are you doing, Scott?
All right. Flagship is pretty August term, but
I think you
anyway, appreciate it.
We also have with us the host of not one, but two podcasts, overachiever. That would be Stephen Guerra. Steve, say hi.
Hi.
Steve, of course, hosts the great podcast, Beyond the Big Screen and the History of the Papacy. We also have with us the host of the This American President podcast, Ricard Ivanovich Limsky.
That's not my name.
Ah, just kidding. Richard Lim, we're going to make him give him a Russian name because he always does Russian stuff.
Just for today.
Just for today. Yeah. And last but not least, we have the new kid on the block. And that is the host of our newest podcast, Eyewitness History. Fantastic show, Josh Cohen. Josh, say hi.
Hi, how's it going, fellas?
All right, it's going good. We're going to have a great debate here. We've got four very different historical events that we're going to discuss. I myself am not going to do one this time. I'm just going to moderate because as we get more and more people, we don't want to make this show go on for hours and hours and hours. So we're going to start with Josh, the new guy. He's going to be in the leadoff position. You're in the hot seat, Josh. So Josh, if you could go back in time and eliminate one event, what would you do and why?
All right, fellas. Well, I'm going to do us all of us a couple of favors here. So I'm going to save millions of lives. And by extension, I'm going to save millions, actually billions of dollars. I'm going to rid the world of a psychopathic mass murdering maniac. Not a bad day's work there. Create at least a little bit of peace in the Middle East, and I'm going to free up a vast majority of the world's oil wealth. And depending on where you land on it, save America a few potential historical blunders from a foreign defense policy. So, James and company, the event that I'm going to remove is the 1979 Ba'athist Purge. So the purge occurred July 22nd, 1979. Now, this I get that this is a bit of a esoteric event. I want to kind of fix in our listeners' minds the event itself and what I think would not have occurred had the event not happened. So Iraq was best captured, I think, under its old regime form by an author named Kenan Makia, who wrote a book called The Republic of Fear. And I say this because in addition to the book, he also produced a program for PBS. And in the video, in the broadcast, you can actually see in real time footage, this incredibly chilling video. And it shows the actual moment that Saddam Hussein achieved and consolidated ultimate power for himself in Iraq. The day that Saddam Hussein actually became the Saddam Hussein as we knew him, is recorded for posterity. We don't have that moment in, say, Germany with the Night of the Long Knives, right? We know roughly what happened, that Hitler realized he had to massacre every rival, not just in German politics, but within his own party, which is, of course, the crucial thing. So trying to condense my time as best I can, basically, 1979, there's a meeting of the Central Committee, and Saddam Hussein is chairing the whole thing from a podium smoking a large cigar. And there's about 100 people sitting in the conference room. Without warning, one of the Ba'athists, a senior member of the Ba'athist Party, whose name I'm sure I'm going to butcher, Muhi Abdul Hussein, hope I got that right, was someone who's been, he's dragged on stage, and he's very obviously been tortured, been beaten. And he goes up to the podium and stumbles through a confession that effectively implicates himself and others in a plot to destroy the Iraqi public and to remove the regime of the Ba'ath Party and to ruin the Iraqi revolution. So having, you know, confessed for himself that he had committed this crime, he then begins to take out a piece of paper and say the following members of the Ba'ath Party were with me in this plot. And he begins to read out their names. And these are people that are in the audience, guys. So you literally can see on the video, the guards pulling the people out of their chairs and out onto the street. Now, as this is happening, as you might imagine, there's a frenzy going on within the audience. So they start screaming and howling and hoping that they won't be the ones removed. You know, they start screaming glory to Saddam Hussein, our leader, the sun, the moon, the stars, and nothing matters. They're one by one just taken off the chessboard. And at the end of the event, I think we had something, it was 68 people who were arrested. And then 22 were sentenced to execution. And over the course of the next week, hundreds more members of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party were executed as well. So that's the crux of the event. I could go in a lot further, but I'm trying to be sparing with my time as I can. So this is the day that Saddam Hussein, like I said, becomes the Saddam Hussein as we knew him, replacing the, at the time, President Hassan al-Bakr, who was actually a rather loved, I don't want to say democratic, but not quite a Saddam Hussein. So there are three main points that I believe that this purge affected, and I wanted to touch on: Iran, Syria, and oil. So on the point of Iran, the purge removed many seasoned Ba'athist politicians and diplomats as well, who almost certainly would have opposed Saddam Hussein's ill-fated decision to invade Iran 12 months later. You know, and that's about 1.25 million lives saved right there, right? And, you know, Iran itself had experienced a revolution just 5 months earlier, and the Ba'athists feared that Iran's new leaders would destabilize Iraq by mobilizing Iraq's dormant Shia population. So in this, Saddam Hussein saw a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to annex and expand to a greater Iraqi territory, Iran, and acquire the immense resources at the expense of a weakened Iran, right? So this purge and those which followed immediately after effectively eliminated all threats to Saddam's power inside Iraq and his agenda for Iran. Additionally, we would have been spared the gassing of the Kurds in Halabja, the Kurds, who I believe are still the largest stateless minority in the Middle East and I think the world. But the chemical attack, which occurred a little under 10 years later, 1988, basically killed about 15,000 people, to say nothing of the chemical burns, the cancer-causing chemicals that would, you know, destroy generations to come. So we would have been spared that. That's on Iran. But so on the point of oil, in annexing Kuwait, Saddam Hussein immediately seized, I believe it was 20% of the world's oil reserves for himself, in addition to securing a substantial coastline on the Persian Gulf. And additionally, I want to point out the dreaded oil for food program, which it was basically, to make a long story short, a scam that put something like $4 billion back into the pocket of Saddam Hussein. And these are things that I think we could do well without. And had he not committed the purge, we would be without. Voila.
All right. Well, that's a pretty persuasive case. That's a lot of lives saved, a lot of money saved. Steve, what do you think about that? What's your reaction?
I wonder who was going to be running the show then if Saddam didn't take over?
It would have been Hassan al-Bakr. So he was the Iraq's president at the time. He was taken ill, and he was also him and his family were under threats by Saddam Hussein, who was, you know, strong-arming him. And I think apparently they were cousins, funny enough. So there was that as well. But yeah, Hassan al-Bakr. Basically, the purge doesn't happen if Hassan al-Bakr isn't intimidated and taken ill.
I mean, it sounds plausible to me. I mean, certainly Saddam was no historical good guy. So I'd say I'm leaning towards supporting that one. Plausible.
Richard, what do you think about that?
So I guess is the idea that if he doesn't purge, he's not in power at all. and Hassan Bakr stays in power, right?
Well, it's not that he's not in power at all. He was a senior member of the Ba'athist party, but he's not a dictator. He doesn't have total power. Yeah, that does go to Hassan al-Bakr. Yeah, so it's a power consolidation grab, just like the Night of the Long Knives.
Sure. Well, I like it. Good job. Saved a lot of lives.
I try my best. It's a good day's work, right?
Maybe no Gulf War too. Huh?
It's hard to not want Saddam it's not hard to not want him not in power. So
as I was prepping for this, I'm like, man, I can't wait to hear some pro Saddam arguments.
I don't think you're going to get any. Nope. Scott Reich, what do you think of this idea?
I've missed him deeply ever since he was hanged. So it's been a hard one for me. And eBay and Kusei, I loved those Hussein's boys as well. Sons.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when you mentioned him, it really got my gears turning, because 20th century Middle Eastern political science, it seems all about choosing between a bad and worse alternative. It seems like the best you can really hope for is, James will love this, I'm going to bring in Mustafa Kemal Ataturk here, which it seems like I was, during our World War One series, I kept going back to him. He really, I mean, in this type of political environment, the best you can, I suppose, hope for is a good-natured, benevolent dictator. Right. The problem is, even if they're really good, they don't give up power. And then you have like a Muammar Gaddafi who's at the United Nations giving a 4 or 6 hour speech. Now, Ataturk, again, to his eternal credit, had the good graces to be an alcoholic, a high functioning alcoholic who died of cirrhosis of the liver. And he got in and he got out before he got really bad. So you don't have Muammar Gaddafi moments or Vladimir Putin for whatever good he's done for Russia when he consolidated power. Many would argue at this moment that he's overstayed his welcome. So perhaps the alternative to Saddam Hussein would be a strong man that would rule better. And who's to say that Saddam Hussein wasn't better than he was in later years? So early Saddam was slightly better than later Saddam. But you know what? I'm going to take it. I think that we could have had a situation in Iraq where we have a better benevolent dictator who could have had a little bit more order there. So you could have something like a Jordan or the early decades of Libya before Muammar Gaddafi is giving 6 hour speeches at the UN. So, you know what? I'm going to take it.
All right. Sweet. I'll just throw in a little 2 cents. I said this a minute ago, but I'm not sure if it came through. But with no Saddam, obviously no Gulf War, no Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and no second Iraq War in the early 2000s. And that would be an especially nice thing to not have that, I think. So, yeah. All right. Let's move on to our next person now. Stepping into the batter's box, so to speak, is Steve. Steve, what event would you eliminate from history and why? And what good would it do?
All right. Well, I'm stepping outside a little bit of what I normally do in my history of the papacy, but I'm going to, and I'm hoping that I get this one by because I have the hosts of key battles of the Civil War here. So I'm hoping to at least get some decent marks. My assertion is that the South doesn't fire on Fort Sumter in all the way back in 1861, which will be the catalyst that actually starts the hot war of the Civil War. Now, so just to quickly do the short timeline, go and listen to Key Battles of the Civil War. But
yes,
for my purposes here, and what will happen is if this one event is taken out of the timeline, slavery ends early, millions of people don't get killed, and basically it's Shangri-La after that. But so hear me out. Abraham Lincoln's was elected in November 16th, 1860. In December of 1860 to January of 1861, the Southern states begin to form secession conventions, and several of them secede. The new Confederate government was formed in February of 1861. Lincoln's inaugurated in March 1861. And then the first shot was fired by the Confederates at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor on April 12th, 1861. But so once the Southern states seceded, the war didn't break out immediately. There was about a 2-month period of the Confederacy and the Union, not knowing exactly what to do, Lincoln was steadfast for preserving the Union. The South or Confederacy wanted to break away because they knew big things were going to change with slavery whenever Lincoln was elected, and really that slavery was as a these slave states being a part of the Union, slavery was not going to be a going concern anymore, and that's why they had to secede. The big question was in that couple of month period was what to do with all the federal property located in the breakaway seditious states. Back at that time, it was mostly military assets, forts, weapons, et cetera. There were custom houses and other federal property, but the real bulk of it and what the Confederacy was concerned with was getting those military assets. And this, I mean, the division of assets is always the stickiest issue in any sort of a dissolution of an entity, and such as a divorce, and splitting assets is hard even under the best of circumstances. February through early April of 1861 was definitely the far from the best of circumstances. So this is what actually happened. The issue of Fort Sumter and its garrison, they stopped receiving supplies from South Carolina, local supplies, and they began to run out of supplies. Lincoln said he wouldn't reinforce the garrison, but he would resupply it. And the Confederates said no to that. And it was a back and forth issue because neither the Federals nor the Confederates wanted to be seen as the belligerents of firing the first shot. The commander of Fort Sumter, Major Anderson, was close to surrendering because the supplies didn't seem to be coming. In the actual timeline, Anderson didn't surrender, and then the Confederates attacked, hence starting the Civil War. And the key thing that I'm going to focus in is 5 days later, Virginia seceded and joined the Confederacy. Now, this is what happens if the Battle of Fort Sumter doesn't happen. So why might it not happen? And I think there's a lot of different reasons. It could maybe Major Anderson does surrender. He just can't hold on any longer. Maybe Lincoln just orders the evacuation of Sumter. It could be out of weakness. He could see an opportunity. Maybe he just delays too long. I mean, he's just fresh president at that point. Or maybe the Confederates decide not to attack and starve out the defenders. You know, you could really see it go any way. Now, here's what the fallout to me is of no firing on Fort Sumter is Virginia does not secede. Virginia as a whole was not pro-secession. It was, I mean, there's no polling, but it was fairly unpopular. And it was really a bunch of firebrands that came to the secession convention and got everything fired up after the Battle of Fort Sumter. If there's no firing, I don't see them gaining any traction. So Virginia doesn't secede. The Federals' response with the Anaconda Plan, because it's really the only plan that they have on the books, and it was a pretty good plan. Now picture the South without Virginia. It's completely cut off. France or England aren't going to get involved. For what purpose? And that puts a lot of pressure on the Confederates, especially New Orleans, Charleston, and the port cities. I see Tennessee and Kentucky, they just get put down in complete lockdown, martial law. Lincoln does an early version of the Emancipation Proclamation, which doesn't affect Virginia, Maryland, or Delaware because they're all in the Union. It's maybe awkward and it ruffles some feathers, but nobody really wants to start trouble over that. A huge new army is raised, including a federal army of Northern Virginia. There's really no need to use this army yet because the Anaconda program or plan is working so well. And then so the next step is some of the marginal states in the Confederacy, they float overtures to come back to the Union, maybe Texas, Louisiana, Florida, North Carolina, Arkansas, maybe pro-Union areas in the South like Appalachia go into full revolt. The Confederates have very few resources to put down these revolts. Now, just to make to shorten it up, it's really by 1862 or so, you really only have a few Confederate states that are left. and they're crushed by the new super mega Union army, and it really isn't even a fight, then really the states that didn't capitulate early, the southern states, they get treated more harshly than the states that threw in the towel early, but they're all eventually readmitted into the Union. The last slave states, the ones that didn't secede, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, they see the writing on the wall, a constitutional amendments passed to end slavery. And really, that's the wars ended, slavery's ended probably by late 1862. I see some possible negative impacts. I think since the rebellion's crushed so early, really in maybe as little as 18 months, Lincoln maybe doesn't change his views on colonization of African Americans and the former slaves. I think you might see a possibility, because it ended so fast, of no universal suffrage and citizen rights for African Americans. So, you know, maybe no 14th Amendment. But I think in the end, a lot less people killed and slavery still ended. So that's my case.
All right. That is an interesting case. Richard, what is your response to that? What would you say?
So I guess is the idea that it wouldn't just be Fort Sumter, the attack not happening, but there would be no spark that would lead that to happen. Because I'm also thinking that the Anaconda plan was a blockade. And in effect, that would have started the war. Because when I'm hearing that specific moment of the Battle of Fort Sumter, I'm thinking that's when the war starts, right? Because of that battle. So are you saying that if that didn't happen, but the Union goes in and does the blockade, then effectively they're able to take out the effectiveness of the Confederacy right off the bat? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it really turns it into a Cold War that they're blockading, but it's not the Confederates really didn't have anything to, without Virginia especially, to go against a blockade, an effective blockade. It would have just been a Cold War for several months that are really just completely draining those core Confederate states without Virginia, you know, that they didn't have a lot of money or military resources or anything to begin with.
Yeah. I think it's a very interesting thing. It sounds like a lot of things have to align for what you were saying, that let's say the blockade happens and it, in effect, it is a war that starts. One of the reasons why Lincoln was able to, one of the big propaganda victories Lincoln had was that he allowed the South to fire the first shot, right? Otherwise, he doesn't have that. Let's say imposing the blockade is seen as the North acting aggressively. Maybe that turns Virginia towards the Confederacy in and of itself. I don't know. But yeah, it just it seems a few things do have to align for that.
Yeah.
But hey, we would all love for the war to have been less painful and slavery to have been abolished sooner, right?
Yeah, we'll take that as a W.
Yes.
Scott, what do you think about this? What are your reactions?
Well, I agree strongly that there's a lot about the Civil War that is contingent. It didn't need to happen. It seems like the sides really stumbled into it. Of course, the North and the South had animosities based on slavery, but how it would resolve could have gone any number of ways. The thing I was really thinking about with your case was the question of emancipation. And could that have happened without the war? Now, of course, it could have happened, because all throughout the Western Hemisphere, there was slavery. All throughout the British colonies, there was slavery. Brazil was a huge slave nation, and they were able to emancipate their slaves without a war. Now, they had to pay money. This is called a compensation emancipation. So the British Empire paid a huge amount. It was something like 40% of its national budget to slave owners. And this was issued in bonds. And I read somewhere it wasn't paid off until 2015. Something like that happened in Brazil as well. But then there was this informal kind of slavery that went on, and you can still see some lingering effects of human trafficking. So in the United States, to simply emancipate slaves without any kind of compensation, I think that would have led to resentment of Southerners who saw a lot of their wealth in the form of their slaves essentially evaporate. And that could have led to simmering resentment, a similar type of Jim Crow situation. As Steve mentioned, maybe we don't have a 13th or 14th Amendment. If there were compensation emancipation, which Lincoln was pushing for, and it did happen in DC, then I think, you know, there wouldn't have been Jim Crow. I mean, maybe Reconstruction, well, you wouldn't even really need it, because you wouldn't have to rebuild anything. So the economic disaster that the South faced after the war could have perhaps been spread around the United States. I don't know if that would have happened. If anyone could have pulled it off, it would have been Lincoln to push for something like that, using the example of the British Empire and other nations that would have gone for compensation, emancipation. So if that's the case, that would have been great. If not, then I don't know if you could just simply announce emancipation without paying anyone and it would have been fine and the South would have accepted it. So James is much more the authority on these matters, but that's my take.
I'm going to jump in if I may. Sorry, Josh, you'll get your time in just a minute. But yeah, I got to push back against you, Steve. I do not, well, I can almost guarantee you that emancipation would not have happened in 1862, even if there'd been no war. I'm going to piggyback on what Scott was saying, because if you think about it, in 1861, very few Northerners wanted emancipation or even cared about it. The abolitionists were a small minority in 1841. But as the war progressed, the war actually changed a lot of people's hearts. The war, as it progressed and more bodies piled up, people in the North began to have a harder attitude toward the South, and they wanted
Lincoln included.
Right. Especially Lincoln. Yeah. They really wanted to punish the South. And I would say, again, as you said, they didn't have polls, but public opinion in favor of emancipation was much higher in 1865 than it was in 1861. In fact, it was much higher in 1865 than it would have been in 1864, even. It continued to increase. Now, your initial premise, if there had been no firing on Fort Sumter, I agree there would have been no war. Lincoln could have just evacuated the fort. In fact, some of his cabinet members advised him to do just that. However, if they had put in a blockade, I'm going to agree with Richard. I think the South would have seen that as an act of war. But who knows? The South might have gone on the offensive, and that would have been a disaster for them. But I also agree with you that if Virginia had stayed in the Union and the other three so-called Upper South states, the Confederacy would have had zero chance. They had not that much of a chance even with the Upper South. But when you take away the industry, not that there was a ton of it, but there was a fair amount of industry in Virginia. You had the economy in Tennessee was strong, North Carolina. But I can't go with the emancipation in 62 thing. Sorry.
I'm going to push back. And okay. I think that the emancipation, now, Lincoln could have very easily have done something like an Emancipation Proclamation as just to put the heat onto the Southerners, to the actual rebellious states. And it would have been just the same effect as it was during the real timeline, that it wouldn't have affected Virginia, that was still in, there would have still been slavery during the war in Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. I think those were the three main slave states that stayed in the Union. Well, not Virginia, but Maryland. Did Kentucky stay in the Union?
Kentucky stayed in the Union, yes.
So the Emancipation Proclamation didn't affect them either. No. I think that by the time in my timeline, they would have kicked the can down the road with slavery in Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware. And really, Virginia was pretty, I was doing a little research, was fairly well industrialized.
Yeah.
Maybe not as much as New York or Massachusetts, but it wasn't too far away. And slavery wasn't that common. It had gone down quite a bit in Virginia.
Somewhat. Mm-hmm.
Especially their economy wasn't so slave driven as, say, the cash crop states like South Carolina,
Mississippi,
Louisiana.
Alabama. Yeah. Yeah. I can see where you're coming from there. I think if there had been no war and if Lincoln had issued any type of Emancipation Proclamation, then you would have lost the South. In fact, you might have even lost Kentucky and Missouri and Maryland. But who knows? I might be wrong. James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
I mean, it could depend on how much the animosity had grown between in the Cold War period, that I'm saying that would be about a year to 18 months.
Yeah. I think you could do a whole podcast episode just on this one question.
Well, and that assumes that a similar event like Fort Sumter doesn't happen somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you might have had another similar incident like the fort down in Florida. I'm forgetting the name of it off the the Union ended up holding it. Plus, there was Fortress Monroe in Virginia that remained in Union hands. But anyway, Joshua, what do you think?
Yeah. So actually, I want to piggyback off what Richard said. So I did a little bit of research, and I'm by no means a James Early.
That's probably a good thing for you don't want to be.
But one of the things that I had read is that if they hadn't fired on Fort Sumter, then it simply would have occurred at Fort Pickens.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Right. And that Lincoln knew this, and that was why a portion of the resupply mission was secretly diverted to that location. Don't know how that sounds, but I think first off, I like it. If we are able to end slavery a little bit earlier, let's go ahead and do it. I think the South would have succeeded in secession. Seems to me like I think Virginia would have been split. When Virginia, you know, purported to secede, Virginia ought to have declared that, you know, this doesn't apply to the former portion of the district, which we concede to federal territory. You know, Virginia ought, in its ordinances of secession, have expressly declared that we present no claim or threat to the capital of the Union. Because I feel like one of the main dramas of this story was Lincoln's military onus, what he had accomplished strategically and militarily, and whether a threat was posed to him. And it brought up a lot of questions, I think, for Lincoln. You know, how do I persuade the northern states to raise and send troops? What do I tell them? What do I tell them to do? What's a workable military plan to subdue the larger states? I feel, and I could be dead wrong, and I'm sure James Early will whack me on the head if
maybe.
But I feel like Lincoln wouldn't have any real good answers to these questions. I think it was the Confederate threat to Washington that would have solved all of Lincoln's problems. So Lincoln had the army he needed, and it was just a matter of getting more and more troops involved. And then I think the Southerners solved Lincoln's second problem by placing their own capital in Richmond, Virginia, the only Southern city that was close enough to the Union to be a credible target to Lincoln. If we capture this, we win the war and we end the Confederacy, right? So that's my quick two cents. And I'm just curious, Steve, if in your alternate timeline, if you see that shot just simply happening at another fort.
I think that kind of the whole thing of mine is that nobody's willing to take that first shot, which was in the actual timeline. There was that nobody wanted to be seen as the one who fired the first shot. And I think that for what I was really going for is that they keep doing that. It's brinksmanship, but that first shot never gets taken, which then doesn't spark the secession, the firebrands in Virginia to get them to flip Virginia.
Right.
All right. Well, good discussion. We need to move on for the sake of time. So now coming up is Ricard Ivanovich. Are you going to do something Russian this time? You're 2 for 2 on Russia. So far,
I think in an indirect way, sure.
Indirect.
Yeah. So you guys are like in the business of saving millions and millions of lives from getting murdered and all that stuff.
It's what we do.
And that's all great. But, you know, to quote Norm Macdonald, who once talked about Oscar Pistorius, I don't have a problem with the murders. What really bothers me is when people have really stupid conspiracy theories. Now, I'm not against conspiracy theories. I'm not against the idea of conspiracies, because conspiracies have happened in history, like the great triumvirate of Caesar and Crassus and Pompey. You know, okay, that was a micro conspiracy. But, and I don't know, some people might think I'm wrong, some people might think I'm naive, but most macro conspiracy theories are really bad. They're not very logical. They usually involve, I think a lot of them, they thrive on ignorance, but if people love to scrutinize the official story, but if they applied that same scrutiny to their own theory would collapse. And that's what I often find in, you know, conspiracy theories, whether it's like, you know, were the Apollo missions faked, the moon landings faked and all that stuff. Most people who say that they're faked haven't even talked to someone who actually studies physics. And I think a lot of this came because, not all of it, but a lot of it came because of a crazy moment in American history. It really was crazy. I mean, here you have President Kennedy being assassinated November 22nd, 1963. And there's always this sense that it's one of those moments, it's like 9/11, where it's like a loss of innocence. And then 2 days later, Jack Ruby goes on national television and murders Lee Harvey Oswald. And at that point, understandably, there was immediate belief in a conspiracy that Oswald was silenced and that there, you know, he was maybe he knew about a conspiracy, maybe he was set up. But then there was this belief that Jack Ruby was part of a conspiracy that silenced Lee Harvey Oswald, so we would never know the truth about the Kennedy assassination. And that has effectively turned the Kennedy assassination into an industry in which people have made so much money peddling theories about the Kennedy assassination, which so many of which don't stand up to scrutiny at all. I mean, there are books that are just blatant lies about the Kennedy assassination. There was a book I remember as a kid by a doctor named Charles Crenshaw, who was at the hospital where Kennedy was wheeled in after he had been shot. And so he wrote this book. I think it's called A Conspiracy of Silence. He later said that the people that wrote the book exaggerated his role in the whole thing. But it's just yet another book, you know, that was that you know, the authors made money on it and blah, blah, blah. And people will believe anything. They want to believe in a conspiracy. But the evidence, if you look at what happened with Jack Ruby, the evidence pretty much shows that it's pretty ridiculous to think he was involved in a conspiracy. As people who know the story, he was a nightclub owner in Dallas. And like many nightclub owners, he knew the police and he would go into the police station. And basically, he happened to be right in front of Oswald as they were trying to transfer him. It was on national TV. He stepped out, shot him. Now, this is a pretty violent guy. He was known for beating up customers at least 25 previous occasions. Anyone who knew him said that he was too unstable to have been part of a conspiracy. A lot of people said the same thing about Oswald. But the reason we know that it's unlikely that Ruby was involved in the conspiracy is because just moments before he shot Oswald, he was at a bank right next door. And at that bank, he waited patiently to wire money to an employee. And we have the date stamp on that in that transaction, 11:17 a.m. And then literally 5 minutes later, he walked into the police station, shot Oswald. Oswald was being held longer than he should have been because the interrogator wanted to get information out of him. But the timestamp was 11:17, right before he happened to see Oswald. He waited patiently. There was no way he could have known how long he would have had to be in line to talk to the teller to wire the money, yada, yada, yada. Now, it's pretty crazy to think this is a complete coincidence, but guess what? That's history. Lots of things are coincidence, right? So a few months ago, we talked about the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Was it a conspiracy or was it just chance that, you know, the first shot missed and then he happened to run into the Archduke again? That's history. It happens. But because of that assassination, everyone thinks that there's a conspiracy. People, and I think in the last like 10 years, it's been mainstream to believe that anything you don't like that happens is a conspiracy. For anyone that likes truth, for anyone that doesn't like simplistic answers to questions where you just assume that everyone you don't like is that brilliant that they can orchestrate a massive conspiracy to do things like assassinate a president. I think if you eliminate this moment, first of all, we would have had Oswald alive. He would have been tried. We would have had more answers. He probably would have been found guilty. I mean, who knows? But I think it's very likely he would have been found guilty. America would probably have dealt with the assassination better emotionally because they never quite got over it. And if you add the Kennedy assassination, the belief in the conspiracy, and basically afterwards with Watergate and Vietnam and the distrust and the erosion of trust in American history, anyone who does not like dumb conspiracy theories and cares about the truth, I think would hope that the mother of all conspiracy theories, the JFK assassination, we could have avoided all that had Ruby not killed Oswald. So there you go.
All right, Scott, your response?
Well, first of all, I'm kind of in awe that you have one ticket to the past to stop one thing, and you're going to use it to save the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. So
one life, you know, one life.
Hold on. No. I am going to use it to allow him to be brought to justice in a court of law.
Okay. He'll probably get the electric chair. I guess when you say it like that, because at first I was going to respond back that It's like you designed a perfectly engineered fart machine where it's greatly designed, but it's still a fart machine. But, you know, when you say it like that, so I do take your point that conspiracy theories, I mean, they don't make sense. I was actually trying to think one time, someone was asking me, is there a case in history of a conspiracy theory working? And I'm not talking about a conspiracy assassinating Caesar, where for a limited period of time, or military deception, World War II, I mean, a major event happened that involved hundreds or thousands of people and was effectively concealed and perhaps is still concealed. And I think, no, I mean, governments are leaky boats. You know, all it takes is one Edward Snowden to blow it up. And
they're not competent.
No, I mean, like NASA couldn't have hit a moon landing when there are many people who are on the dole who would have been incentivized, or, you know, fire doesn't melt steel. So 9/11 was inside job. There's so many people that could have leaked this if that were actually the case. I mean, the best you can possibly do is that you can take facts and a group of people or historians can promote a narrative. So like the Lost Cause myth in the South, so they can cherry pick some of the data that would fit their agenda. You can do that for a while, I guess, if it fits certain people's time and place. But yeah, I agree. Like there's Occam's razor says that Ruby was not part of a grand conspiracy. So, you know, again, like I dispute the idea that if we're going to save one life, it's Lee Harvey Oswald's, but I do like putting down conspiracy theories. So yeah, I'll take that.
All right, Mr. Cohen.
So I'm the one that's going to have to be the apologist for the conspiracy theorists, huh? It's gotten that bad. All right, fair enough.
No.
I'm only against dumb conspiracy theories.
Well, that was going to be one part of my argument was a conspiracy theory can only sensibly be judged on its merits. There's good theories and there's bad theories. The magic bullet theory was postulated by the Warren Commission. So if you want to rest anything on what the official story is, and this is just my opinion, the craziest story is the official given statement. That's the conspiracy. That's the official statement. But the two gunmen on the grassy knoll, for instance, is the conspiracy theory, which in my opinion holds a little bit more water. But conspiracy theories are one of my favorite things to talk about for just that reason. I think Richard, I'm going to push back on the idea that if Lee Harvey Oswald isn't assassinated, that's the end of the conspiracy theories. Because let's not forget, there was a bunch of theories that alleged the involvement of the CIA, of the mafia. Depending on who you ask, there are people that think it went as high as Lyndon Baines Johnson, and that it was something like a coup. Which, by the way, I don't think is true. But these conspiracy theories would have still ran. And let's not forget the Cubans, right? So, yeah, so that's on that. As far as what I believe would have happened, I think I agree with you there. I think Oswald would have had his day in court. He would have been found guilty and he would have either been executed or given life without parole. But let's be honest, it's Texas. So he almost certainly would have been executed. I agree with Scott that it's the chair for Mr. Oswald. Yeah. And then just one last thing, putting a good word for the conspiracy theories. There's a book that I'd recommend to our listeners by one of my former interviewees, actually, James Reston Jr., who wrote a book called The Accidental Victim. And it's basically a whole conspiracy theory that's laid out that sets up the idea that Texas Governor John Connally, who, let's not forget, was in the car with Kennedy that day, was actually the intended victim, the intended target of the assassination attempt, of the assassination.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
So, okay, I have a few responses. The first response is I don't know who among here has been to the site, the Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy was assassinated.
I have.
But the grassy knoll is so wide open where anyone can see you. Sure. It makes no sense for a brilliant mastermind government or mafia or Cubans to say, hey, let's plant a shooter here where everyone can see you. Makes more sense to shoot.
Take that, somebody. Oliver Stone.
Yeah, yeah. It makes more sense to shoot you from a building, snipers from a building. That's what snipers do. So that, like, it's the same. It's the idea that if you put the same scrutiny to the official story, the theory falls apart. The second thing is that most of the conspiracy theories as soon as Ruby shot Oswald, there was the immediate assumption, oh, he must have been silenced. This is a bigger thing. So most of those theories that you mentioned, whether it's CIA or Cuba or military industrial complex, yada, yada, mafia, those came about because of the suspicions that arose because of the killing of Oswald. So I don't necessarily think that they would have had the same environment to thrive in had Oswald lived, because there would have been more answers, more things would have been uncovered. His credibility would have been determined very quickly. But the other thing, too, is that on the magic bullet theory,
yeah,
most times when people debunk it, just like Oliver Stone supposedly did, they show the diagram of Kennedy and Connolly sitting parallel to each other at the same height. But when you actually look at the film and the position, Connolly is actually seated to Kennedy's left, slightly to his left, and he was sitting at an angle, and he was also lower. And when you include that, it's far more likely. I mean, first of all, if Kennedy's getting shot in the back from behind, the bullet has to go somewhere. So the bullet hits his back, comes out of his neck. Who's it going to hit? Connolly. So actually, it's a lot more plausible than people say it is. Also, Oswald was, I mean, his own brother thought he did it. You know, like, I mean, if anyone knows you better than anyone else, your own brother. So anyways, all I'm saying is that, yes, there are a lot of theories, but if you apply the same scrutiny to those theories, look, I wasn't there, obviously. Could Kennedy have been killed by a conspiracy? Sure. Yeah, sure. But here's the thing. Give me a theory that doesn't suck, and I'll actually, and give me a theory. I've heard people say Lyndon Johnson did it, and I asked them why.
Yeah.
Oh, because he became president afterwards. That's not proof. Don't know where the proof is. So give me more than hearsay. Give me more than, oh, well, obviously he killed him. No. Give me something.
You got me.
All right. Steve, do you have anything?
Wait a second. I'm getting a message through my fillings right now. No, I'm not going to bring up MK Ultra. I kid. I want to get a reputation.
Project Artichoke.
I think that there's something to say that if Lee Harvey Oswald had survived and he was somehow punished, they're going to convict him. I don't see that through any means that he's not going to get convicted. That really could have just put the end to it. No matter if there was a conspiracy or not, even if there was a conspiracy, if Lee Harvey Oswald survives, is convicted, is put to death, or whatever happens afterwards, I think the nation can go by without that. What would it looks dirty that Ruby shot him just out of nowhere before Lee Harvey Oswald really has a chance to say anything. Then you compound it with all the hippie stuff and how hippies all went bad in the late 60s, and then Watergate, and then, you know, it all comes back to the
hippies.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. But so I think that you maybe save some of the national innocence with Lee Harvey Oswald not getting killed.
At least not getting murdered.
Well, yeah, I'm not getting murdered at that point, because I think that that's kind of like, I mean, that wasn't as much as Kennedy getting killed. For older people, that was their 9/11 moment, is watching it on TV, Lee Harvey Oswald getting shot. My mother talks about that. When she was a kid, she stayed home sick from school and saw it on TV. Like, it was so unexpected.
Hmm. And it was. I mean, it was a murder on national television. Yeah. It's insane. And it was a murder of a guy who was being held by two law enforcement officers. So, it's an insane story. But mm-hmm. I mean, that's history, right? Insane stories happen sometimes.
That's why we love to read about it, because it's really fascinating and interesting stuff happens.
Richard, I'm just curious if you can guess at what the motive Ruby did have for killing Oswald.
Well, he was a violent guy. I mean, he was his own bouncer at his club, and he beat up customers on 25 different occasions. So this is a guy who knew the cops, but also had a bit of, you know, social immunity, and just, he was a violent person. And just like we see every day, people have crimes of passion. And he was devastated at Kennedy's assassination. He was also fearful. He was a Jew, and he saw a few flyers that were anti-Kennedy, and one of them had a Jewish name on it, and he was afraid that the Jews were going to get blamed for this. And so he went and wanted to redeem himself as a hero to kill Kennedy. That's an educated guess on my part. I mean, not saying I know for sure, but that's what I've read.
None of us know for sure, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I have my theories, but I think that's a definite. We could have another Parthenon podcast right there for a Kennedy conversation.
Just for the record, I'm open to conspiracy theories, just not flimsy, dumb ones. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
And I agree for the record.
We'll have an Oliver Stone's JFK watch party.
Oh, no. Please, no.
4 hour long podcast episode.
All right, Scott, we got to move on. That was a great discussion about Kennedy. But Scott, you have your case to make. What event would you eliminate?
Okay, mine is the biggest stretch, but you could probably have a turkey shoot with all the holes in the theory, but we have the most to gain. I am going to accelerate the invention of the printing press by 1500, if not 2000 years, by stopping the Bronze Age collapse in 1177. These are two events that have probably never been linked together, so here we go. Get ready for a ride. I'll make my case. So I didn't want to do kind of a sniper shot of, let's stop this specific event that will lead to this event, because Ashton Kutcher has taught us in the butterfly effect that you don't know what will happen if you try to, you know, go precise in history. I'm going to do something much more general. So I think that the greatest advancement that has caused the modern age and all of our technology in the last 500 years comes from one thing, and that is the ease and inexpensiveness of creating, recording, transmitting, cataloging, and storing information. If we have a major war or an economic collapse, we can basically get back on our feet in 5 to 10 years because we have all the knowledge at our disposal. We have libraries and books. But millennia ago, with the collapse of the Roman Empire or the Bronze Age collapse, if civilization falls apart, it can take centuries to get back together because you don't have all of your information available. And the reason I choose the Bronze Age collapse as linking to this is because if I want to accelerate the invention of the printing press, I can't just have Gutenberg born 1,000 years earlier. The printing press was really a global achievement that took the contributions of societies all around the world. You needed paper that was made in China in about 200 BC. You needed the block printing press, which again is made in China in about 800 AD. Okay, so why didn't China invent the movable type printing press? Because of their alphabet. The Chinese alphabet has hundreds, if not thousands, of characters. The Arabic alphabet has hundreds of different characters. So easy movable type doesn't work with their alphabet. You need a Phoenician alphabet that, for our English, just has 26 lowercase letters, 26 uppercase letters, some punctuation, and, you know, throw in some Indian numerals for good measure. So you need that alphabet. And then if you mix it with paper and woodblock printing that evolves into movable type, then it works. But you need global civilization having trade and the transmission of ideas and technologies. It doesn't really come together till the Silk Road is supercharged with the Mongol conquests. But it was almost there. It almost got there thousands of years earlier. And that was during the glorious Bronze Age. And in the Bronze Age, oh, wow, how can I sing enough of the high praise of the Bronze Age? It goes from, it's a movement of trade and things in the Eastern Mediterranean and even Central Asia, all the way in the West Italy, all the way in the East to Afghanistan, Turkey in the North, Egypt and the Arabian Peninsula in the South. And just to give an idea about how great the Bronze Age was and how much stuff was moving around, there was a ship that sunk in 1320 BC that was recovered, and it had copper and tin in it. The copper was from Cyprus. The tin was from Afghanistan. There was gold and silver from Greece and Egypt. The wood in the ship's hull was from Lebanon. You have palaces and documents being written in Mycenae. And so this is part of Bronze Age civilization, the Hittite Empire, Egypt, the Assyrians, things like that. Basically, it all comes crashing down in what historians call the Bronze Age collapse. Some have targeted it as specifically as 1177 BC. We don't exactly know what happened. Egyptian hieroglyphs have reference to a group of people called the Sea Peoples. Maybe they originated in Ukraine. There's all sorts of different theories. They don't have records. What we do know is that in a very short window of time, there's all sorts of archaeological evidence of basically a giant burn layer. So the Hittite capital is destroyed and the Hittite empire disappears. The Mycenaean empire is destroyed. So some people think that the Iliad is a retelling of the destruction of Troy that Homer wrote centuries later. Egypt is not destroyed, but it enters a long twilight. So what happens, like, for example, with Mycenae, only about 1% of the population is literate. When their capital is destroyed, they become illiterate. I mean, their educated population disappears. They lose their alphabet. Greeks can't even write until centuries later when the Phoenicians come along and give them an alphabet they can communicate in again. So by not allowing the Bronze Age collapse to happen, the growth of the late Bronze Age will continue. Trade networks will continue to happen. Afghanistan is already in this orbit. It could continue onward to India, where you have perhaps some of the daughter states of the Indus River Valley civilizations that are pretty advanced in 2000 BC. They could be pulled in. Eventually, you get the big dog, which is China. You're kicking off a Silk Road at this time. Who's to say you can't have simple shipping technology that goes from the humble trireme, and triremes in the Mediterranean perhaps can link up with Egypt and then have overland trade to the Red Sea, which could then go around the Arabian Peninsula. You could have shipping outposts along the Indian Ocean. There's not a lot of technological difference between a trireme and the caravel, which Columbus used to reach the New World. So with necessity being the mother of invention and more trade happening, maybe we could have better shipping, an earlier age of discovery. So China is pulled in, you have this trade and commerce, and then the ingredients are all there. And out of this witch's brew, you have yourself a printing press, a movable type printing press around 500 BC. The Sumerian language survives. Epic of Gilgamesh in its original form survives. All this stuff is happening, and I've snapped my fingers, and we're in this alternate timeline. Oh, what? We're on the moon. You know, we've advanced by 1,500 or 2,000 years in this alternate timeline. So this is much more of a stretch to say, but anyway, that's my argument right there. I'm going to stop the Bronze Age collapse and accelerate the invention of the printing press, which allows us to catalog and produce information cheaply and easier much earlier, and we've accelerated the timeline in whatever alternate form it takes. So what do you guys think?
Josh, what do you think?
Good grief. Not much I can really argue with there. I guess my question concerns what the environment was like at the time. As you pointed out, Scott, and this is going to be part of what I was thinking of as you were talking, we don't really know what caused the collapse, right? And since politics was back then, as it is now, often a zero-sum game between contesting empires. So one of my questions is, in this alternate timeline, are the Hittites and the Egyptians still fighting in Kadesh?
Probably. Fun fact, the first battle of which we have a treaty, and we have treaties from both sides. So, you know, that's fun. Yeah, I mean, I suppose if one ransacking people can destroy your civilization, then maybe it's kind of weak to begin with. And part of what also triggered the Bronze Age collapse was, as we appreciate in 2022, their supply chain collapses. So if we're vulnerable today with our super tankers, how much more vulnerable then? So one could argue that if not then, it could have been another thing. But yeah, it's a tricky proposition.
Perfect. Thanks. I like it.
Yeah, they had all those cargo containers piled up and they couldn't get them out of the port. And all
all of the Phoenician red tape, you know, that's they just right. Can't get all their stuff. They're
not enough truck drivers.
If it means less conspiracy theories, sign me up.
We are quickly degenerating here. No, I'm just kidding. Steve, what's your thought about this? No Bronze Age collapse.
I guess that's my big thing, is that since we don't really know the specifics, and that there were a lot of fragilities built into their system, that they were so dependent on weather for their agriculture. I mean, it could have been like 15 things that piled up, but I dig it. I think that if there was no Bronze Age collapse, that really did put Western civilization and Near East civilization back for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So I could very well see that a lot of inventions and societal institutions could have picked up steam a lot more quickly if they hadn't been knocked back. I mean, you look at things like the fall of the Roman Empire, which was kind of a similar situation. It didn't knock back civilization that long. Things were able to recoup a little bit quicker because they did have less of a knowledge problem. You know, if society had a little more time to build up a little bit more cultural baggage, you might say good baggage, then maybe things could have picked up more quickly.
Right. Richard, you get the final word here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's a very interesting point, because people talk about different turning points in history. And I think that people talk about the fall of the Roman Empire and what, you know, the end of the classical antiquity age and all that stuff. But not a lot of people talk about this in particular. And the key to this, I think, is the literacy rate there that was essentially extinguished. But that was kind of like the seed of enlightenment that could have continued on. And, you know, in those kind of things, innovation can really just branch out in very unexpected ways. So I like it because it's a spotlight on a critical moment that I don't think I had ever thought about, really. You just kind of think of, you think of that era as kind of the prelude to what would happen to ancient Greece and ancient Rome and all that kind of stuff. But it was a loss in and of itself. So I'm cool with it. I'm cool with it.
Yeah, like what you were saying, that if they would have had a few more people that were literate, they could have had the escape velocity to weather things. So it's sort of like with the Bronze Age collapse, you get to see what it's like if the Roman Empire falls, but there aren't any monasteries around and scriptoriums to record things. It really stinks. So you know what? Those monks, they're all right.
Yeah, they saved civilization.
Pro monk. Yeah.
Yeah. Scott Rank, pro monk. Pro monk.
Yes. Right. Well, anybody have any final words before we sign off? This has been fun.
Yeah, this was a pleasure.
It was heavy, but it was good.
If we could save the life of Lee Harvey Oswald, then it was all worth it to me.
That guy gets a bad rap, let me tell you. That guy Oswald.
Ooh. Hero.
Let the listener beware. Yes. Yes. This is called sarcasm.
All right. Yeah. Sarcasm.
Just in case. Slash S. Yes.
Yeah. Josh Cohen, biggest fan of Lee Harvey Oswald.
That's the hashtag on this episode, by the way. Okay.
Well, all right. Thank you so much, everybody. Thanks, fellas, for your research and your thoughts. And listeners, be sure and check out our podcasts. Be sure and check out Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, This American President by Richard Lim, History Unplugged by Scott Rank, History of the Papacy and Beyond the Big Screen by Steve Guerra. And if you wouldn't mind, maybe check out Key Battles of American History by me as well. And we will post this on all of our feeds so you'll hear it. And we'd like to hear your thoughts. Who do you think presented the best case and why? Or maybe there's another event that you think would be even better to stop or to prevent. So let us know what that might be. We're going to post this on various places in social media, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and suggestions for another Parthenon podcast roundtable discussion. What would you like us to discuss or debate? So thank you very much again, and we will see you next time. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, and Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Anna Concepcion Castro, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Scott Hendricks, Who's Your Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.